undocumented workers. And of course, those penalties were perverted into wholesale discrimination against undocumented workers. So in 1999, based on a lot of the good organizing that was done by immigrant rights groups and labor forces, the AFL-CIO reversed its stance on IRCA and announced that it was no longer supporting that approach to immigration. So the labor movement has made some advances in that area. We haven't come far enough, but we've made some advances.
That's a good segue to my next question. And as you know, the early U.S. labor movement was influenced by migrants, primarily from Europe. They believed in organizing the unorganized, and by the 1950s, as we've pointed out, one-third of all workers belonged to unions. Tell us how that benefited them as well as non-union workers.
Well, a lot of the organizing that was done in the CIO years of the 30s was done based on the tremendous energy, commitment, vision, and intelligence of immigrant workers. And much of the organizing revolved around language clubs. You know, you had the Finns and the Italians and the Hungarians. They all had their own language clubs and mutual benefit associations. And those organizations played a prominent role in moving the organization of steel and auto and electrical. So immigrants have always played a crucial role in our movement. And that was certainly true in the Justice for Janitors uprising in the late 80s and early 90s. The massive organization of thousands of new janitors took place based on the talent and energy and commitment of Mexican workers, but largely Central American workers, many of whom were political refugees from countries like El Salvador, where there was tremendous political repression against radical and left-wing forces. So we benefited tremendously from that diaspora and that talent. I worked directly with some of those folks in Los Angeles and the organizing I did there.
34 years ago, President Ronald Reagan destroyed the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization. Do you believe that the AFL-CIO and its affiliates' response to that attack was sufficient? And secondly, do you believe that we've ever recovered from that attack?
Well, this was a really interesting situation, and how ironic that the Professional Air Traffic Controllers, PATCO, was a pretty conservative union that actually supported and funded Reagan's campaign and received assurances from Reagan that he would support them and their issues. They had historically been able, through short strikes, to get their way because, of course, air traffic controllers are in an extremely strategically important position in our air travel system. So they thought they could do this again, and Reagan decided to make this a signal moment or a teachable moment to the labor movement that he was going to be tough on labor as an ex-union leader of the Screen Actors Guild, that he was going to take a strong stance against these public employees. Don't forget, these were federal employees, employees of the government, striking against the government, something they had been able to do with impunity in previous administrations. So Reagan takes a strong stand, he fires them all, and the labor movement unfortunately responded with a whimper, not with a roar, and has paid the price for that ever since, because that moment really set the tone for a lot of employers in the private sector who decided, hey, Reagan did this to PATCO, I'm going to lock out these employees, or I'm going to fire all these strikers, and what are you going to do about it? It had a real symbolic effect and a powerful effect. It was a powerful symbol for the labor movement going forward.
So this more or less answers the next question I was going to ask you, was that, do you believe that somewhere along the way, the militancy that our migrant forebears brought to America has waned?
Yeah, I mean, I firmly believe that the U.S. working class is a powerful force, and the work I've been doing with these railroad workers has reaffirmed that confidence that workers given leadership, given training, given hope, given a way to win, we'll stand up and fight and we'll do incredible things to win. I don't think we have to lose our militancy. I think we need to find intelligent ways to reassert that militancy. And I think it has a powerful effect. I'll never forget that when Bob McElrath, the president of the ILWU, sat down on those railroad tracks up in Longview as part of the EGT dispute with that non-union grain terminal, the powerful galvanizing effect that had on other workers who saw that happen. And his willingness to go to jail over that was a very powerful galvanizer for other workers. And as organizing director, I remember getting at least three workplaces in Longview that called up the union and said, we want to be part of that union because you're a union that fights. And so it is true that people will respond to that, but we need to find the ways to do that kind of intelligent exercise of militancy and power. And that incident up there with the grain dispute in the Columbia River is an example of how powerful that militancy, when exercised like that, what kind of an effect it can have on the working class.
So here I am, a worker, and I'm listening to this program, and I want to know, what must I do to achieve economic and social justice for myself and for my kids? What steps, concrete steps, can I take to achieve social justice?
Well, if you're in a union, you got to be sure you're going to the meetings. And even if the meetings are boring and there's not many other people there, you got to go, you got to pay attention, you got to stand up and be counted, you got to run for office if that's what's needed. So if you're in a union, you got to do everything you can to strengthen that union. If you're not in a union, you need to get in touch with a union, or the appropriate union for your workplace. Talk to an organizer, a trained organizer. The ILWU has a wonderful organizer in the Puget Sound named John Breyer, who works for the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, can be contacted in his office in Seattle, and you work with him because he's got all the tools and skills and knows how to put together an organizing campaign that will bring you a union. And thirdly, you need to read everything you can about the history of labor in this country. And there's great books. There's a book called The World of the Worker by James Green, or Them and Us, which is published by the United Electrical Workers by Boyer and Morais. Those two books alone are wonderful books in the history of the labor movement in this country and how much the country's shaped by labor.
What will you be covering in the next installment in the Stansberry Forum?
Well, the next installment will be on the UPS strike, but we're also going to have an article by David Bacon on the change in international policy of the AFL-CIO, what has changed and what hasn't. We're going to have an article by Bill Fletcher on the role of the left in labor and why the new voice's failure to include the left as part of their forces involved in changing the labor movement made it very difficult to do so. And finally, Frank Bardicke, who's an expert on the farm workers in California, is going to write a piece about the strawberry organizing struggle in 1996 in the Pajaro Valley in Salinas, California. So those are a couple of the pieces that are coming in the Stansberry Forum. You can get there at Stansberry, S-T-A-N-S-B-U-R-Y, forum.com.
Thank you, Peter Olney. Thank you for your comments and insight into what must be done to inspire union ranks and file and community groups to join in the ongoing battle to secure social and economic justice for all. We look forward to continuing this interview after more segments of your Stansberry Forum series, Just a Whisper Now, a look back at the AFL-CIO, New Voice After 20 Years, are published.
Well, thanks, Rich. It's always a pleasure to be on this show and to dialogue with you. And again, I remember one of the highlights of that New Voice convention in 1995 was, I think we rode together on a bus from the airport to that Hilton Hotel in Midtown Manhattan. So kudos to you for all the great work you do for the labor movement, and kudos to you for this show.
Well, thank you for saying that. So, folks, there you have it. As Peter Olney and our many guests have stated over and over again here on We Do the Work, we all must involve ourselves in the struggle for social and economic justice for all. Activism is key to progress.
We all have opinions. Here are some of We Do the Work's.
In the July 15th Progressive Populist, writer Jill Richardson drew a canny connection among California's high fines, bureaucratic inefficiency, and Proposition 13. That, however, is only one example of the much bigger problem that our thoughtless war on taxes has left in its wake. For those of you who might have forgotten Proposition 13, it was passed in the 1980s, and it limited property tax rises, so that currently, as I understand it, a person who inhabits a home or has property will not have his taxes rise beyond a minimum percentage until he or she abandons that home or passes away. And then the state has an opportunity to raise taxes, but only then. Taxes are what we charge businesses and individuals for the privilege of profiting from everything that the commons provides. Without the natural resources, the education, the infrastructure, the government-financed research, the customers themselves, there would be no profit. Seems simple enough, obvious even. But we act as if that opportunity to do business and make a profit should have no price attached. Every legislative session, businesses embed more loopholes in the tax code. Hedge fund managers pay federal taxes at a lower rate than do school teachers. The wealthy balance budgets on the back of the poor. The middle class is not immune. It, too, is feeling the hit. All that, the subjects of countless headlines, equally obvious. Still, we avoid asking the equally obvious questions. Do we really wish to allow all profit to accumulate in private hands, or should we use taxes to direct more of that profit back to the community from which it was made? And if we choose the latter, how much is a fair return to society? Another way of asking that question would be to ask how much and in what way should society distribute its collective surplus? While we slept, others have answered those questions for us, and their answers are killing our democracy. The corporate model, which Jim Hightower, in the Progressive Populist and other places, gleefully and entertainingly excoriates week after week, it institutionalizes selfishness. Most corporations live in a I-built-it-myself fantasy world, justification for keeping all profits for themselves. In the last 40 years, we've seen what that does. When the I-did-it-myself fantasy predominates, taxes are lowered, inequality increases, and the ultra-rich have more money available to influence policy. Fertilized by all that money, over that period, while our infrastructure has decayed, corporate lobbying and its outsized influence has become an explosive growth industry. Maybe this is just another way to say what we all know. Money talks. And in our halls of government, through our tax policies and Supreme Court decisions, we have given money the loudest possible voice. But Jill Richardson, in what she wrote, was also pointing to something we don't say explicitly often enough. While most corporate structures are naturally anti-democratic, our tax policies should not be. They should encourage democracy, not stifle it, by assuring that all citizens have a voice equal in opportunity and amplitude. But our tax policies have the opposite effect. By shifting more and more of the nation's surplus to the wealthy, we have not only weakened our individual voices, we have also weakened our government. Richardson recognizes that starved government is, in both senses of that word, poor government. So do the plutocrats, and they like it that way. Handcuffed, poorly functioning government is an easy target, and unless we soon adopt truly progressive tax policies, we will have starved the government beast just as the plutocrats and their spokesmen, like Grover Norquist, have said is their goal. And then that government, that beast over which we do have some control, will have been replaced by the all-devouring corporate beast that cares only for our money and does not even allow us to vote. This is Ken Winkes for We Do the Work.
In our show next week, Ken interviews Doug Holdnick, Communication Director of the Washington State American Civil Liberties Union, about the mission of the ACLU and why our civil rights matter.
That's a wrap. Thank you for listening to We Do the Work, a KSVR studio presentation made possible by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We believe everyone deserves to be treated fairly, and each of us should have the opportunity to live in economic security with dignity and respect. Please send your comments to ksvrwedothework@gmail.com. Our thanks to John Fromer, original composer, and Ann Feeney for our theme song, We Do the Work, from her CD, Union Made. We Do the Work. Visit Ann's website at annfeeney.com.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Oregon Black History Heroes and Legends, a three-day event from September 11th through 13th. The keynote speaker for this 20th anniversary celebration will be Mr. Les Pee-wee Harrison. And other speakers include Imani Muhammad, Mike Crenshaw, Jamo Greenidge, and more. That's Oregon Black History Heroes and Legends, September 11th through 13th at venues across Portland. Location, speakers, and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 6 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Labor Radio. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from True West, presenting American singer-songwriter and former Black Crow Jackie Green with Lauren Shira, Thursday, September 10th at the Wonder Ballroom. Tickets and information for Jackie Green on September 10th at the Wonder Ballroom are available at ticketfly.com.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Holla! Welcome to the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists segment of Labor Radio, highlighting